Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello, who is imbibing today. Nick, you're back on the wagon, or is it off the wagon?
No, I'm back on, but respectfully back on. You know, everything in moderation, including moderation. You know, dry January whiff. So we're going moderation February and moderation 2024. And this Notre Dame game isn't going exactly how I envisioned, so I figured why not get the boys going with an ice-cold, delicious Coors Light.
You and half the student body on the berm that apparently got free chicken sandwiches if they showed up. We are recording this in the middle of the third quarter on Sunday afternoon as the Georgetown Hoyas have just taken a 6-5 lead over the Fighting Irish with 6:25 to go in the aforementioned third quarter. We also just watched the Virginia Cavaliers dispatched the Ohio State Buckeyes 14-8 in Charlottesville. We're going to talk about all that and more. You're going to get an opportunity to hear Nick react to the goals scored by the Hoyas and the goals scored by the Fighting Irish in real time. It is sure to be a treat. Nick Osello, we've got a lot to discuss in the world of college lacrosse this weekend.
We do.
What do you got?
I also will start off by saying across the entire lacrosse landscape, whether it's NLL, PLL, college, it just kind of has that feeling that no lead is safe. No deficit is insurmountable. And as it relates to this podcast, I feel like there are three good games and then a steep cliff where we can kind of do a smorgasbord bag. So we have to start off. There's no other way we can start off without the DU-Cornell game. And what a game this was. It was the reason why I prefaced it with a great comeback. DU is firmly back, 17-16 over Cornell, and what a game. They were down 3 at half. They were down 10-14, and quite simply, it doesn't matter. Silstrop and Manning had 6 points apiece. Ultimately, it was a man-up goal that was the winner. Cursed versus the Irishman, DiBenedetto, was a very fun matchup to watch. And just a really good, you know, kind of fun storylines. DU clawing back, Cornell looking good, DU looking good. But ultimately, DU kind of firmly cements themselves coming back and saying, hey, we're the real deal. Your lead is not safe with us, whether it's Hopkins, whether it's Cornell. And this Matt Brown team, their resilience and their, I would say, comparable only to the Notre Dame teams of the past, where those four goal leads, they're like, it doesn't matter. We're just going to focus. And he even said that in the post game too, where he was just saying, hey, we just focus.
Well,
on
he
the
said
next
that he reminded this team reminded him of Notre Dame teams.
I
of
was
past
reading
years.
Between the lines, and he's like, I really drew a lot of inspiration when Notre Dame would make ridiculous comebacks. But he was just like, hey, we don't care what the score is. Next man in. Focus on what you got to do. And every coach says that. But they're really kind of exemplifying it and are the premier example of that so far in the lacrosse season.
My favorite thing that I heard from this game was in post-game, Bill Tierney, who's doing, I believe, color commentary for their web streams, asked Matt Brown why he didn't get the job 5 years ago.
It's so funny seeing the coaches that, you know, I hated Tierney in college, obviously, but, you know, there wasn't any personal animosity. And now that he's out of the game, I'm like, this guy's awesome. I love this guy.
One more piece of nonsense before we dive into a little bit of the tactics. What do you think of the mountains on the field? I mean, obviously the mountains are blue on your can. You're a Denver native. The whole world seems to hate this, but I haven't heard Nicky O weigh in on the basketball court inspired Peter Barton Stadium turf.
I'm a bit of a contrarian, and anytime somebody hates stuff, I want to like it. Anytime they like stuff, I want to hate it, but I have to go with the populace here. I do not like it. I like it on the basketball court at DU because it's more compact and you can kind of get it in any frame. You understand what's going on. But so many of these highlights, and when you see one possession, you just see kind of like a red jumbled mess at the bottom of your screen. And you're like, what the hell are you doing? So if the game was, you know, on the Big Ten Network and they were filming from 30,000 feet at cruising altitude with a drone, by all means, I think that would look decent. But because lacrosse has a bigger field and they zoom in on those specific parts, I just think it ends up looking kind of stupid. And so I would place DU as the second worst turf in the game behind the Calgary Roughnecks.
Is the Calgary Roughnecks the ones that's like really light blue or teal? I thought that was the Rush.
I think it's the Rough. It might be the Rush.
Yeah, because the Thunderbirds beat the Rush yesterday, and you know how they play Maxine after they win.
Yeah,
you know what I'm talking about here. So they put the video of that meme with Maxine, and it was just replaced the turf. And I thought that they were like making fun of the turf because of the green screen effect. Either way, that's atrocious. I also, I'm going to caveat the entirety of this podcast by saying that on Saturday I covered the Maryland doubleheader. So first was the women's lacrosse game against Florida, which was an incredible Florida comeback. We don't talk that much about women's lacrosse in this podcast, but shout out Emily Heller for her overtime game winner. And then I went over to the men's game. And it's pertinent here because, I mean, the fact that Maryland is the most successful women's lacrosse program, and they play on a field hockey turf facility is insane.
They're the most successful but it's a program. Huge home field advantage. Syracuse and Notre Dame would like a word, Terrence, but continue.
And then secondly, that's why like some of these observations are going to be comparatively surface level because I was catching up this morning and I'm still actually flying through some of these goals from the games that we're going to talk about. But yeah, I mean, you said it. When it comes to resilience, I think that that's the part of, you know, what you can take away from what this season has been for Denver so far. And, you know, I think that the win over Hopkins, where the comeback was so unlikely and significant for establishing its footing for this season, right? You know, at the time, a lot was made of the fact that it was Matt Brown's first win, and appropriately so. I'm not trying to diminish that. But I think that it was looked at a little bit more like in isolation as opposed to what it meant for the season in total. And what I think it means for the season in total now is when you stack a Hopkins win on top of a Cornell win, all of a sudden, like, I don't want to say they're a lock for an at-large bid, but it's hard for me to imagine Denver getting left out of the NCAA tournament based on the way that the season has gone to this point. And it didn't need to because, you know, by all accounts, that Hopkins game should have been like an 11-9 Hopkins win under normal circumstances, right? You play that game 100 times, you get that outcome once, maybe twice. You know, and equivalently, this one maybe wasn't as unlikely, but it was a really high-scoring affair. And, you know, I mean, obviously, we're going to talk about some of the extenuating circumstances. Cornell doesn't have as many games underneath their belt as Denver does. They're playing without Jack Cascadden, who had been their starting faceoff guy and had played really well the week prior. And so as a result, Alex Stathakis had a good day. But he didn't run rampant, especially early. I thought Cornell did a really nice job of kind of mucking it up and, you know, causing violations and getting stuff. Oh, am I talking too much about the faceoff?
No. Notre Dame just scored. Go ahead.
I thought that was the reaction that you do when you're like, no, this is too much face-off talk. Too much face-off talk. Move on.
No. Wait, when that happens, I just, you know, channel my inner Bud Dwyer and then we can continue. But, you know, Stathakis, one of my favorite names to say, another good Irish kid.
No doubt. And so my point is that there are a lot of ways in which this outcome, you know, was kind of against the grain. And I will put my hand up on being wrong on Denver. It appears that I overreacted to their performance against Air Force, but it's also possible that they properly reacted to their performance against Air Force. And, you know, now in back-to-back weeks have put in exceptional performances, you know, first in a kind of one-sided win over Utah and now in a really high quality one goal win over Cornell.
And it kind of like from a player's mindset, like you never focus on the opponent. You always focus on yourself, yet that never happens. You know, we always overanalyze opponents, and especially kind of in these early times where you're kind of seeing what teams are made of, things are kind of shaken out. The two big ones for me, like if I put myself back on any program, whether it's Notre Dame, whether it's, you know, a mid-tier or upper echelon, the two teams that have stuck out the most that if they're on our calendar or on our schedule, I'm just like, okay, you know, we better start thinking about that is Syracuse and DU. I think those have had the two most impressive starts for different reasons. Syracuse kicking in everybody's teeth and then losing an OT to Maryland. And then DU is that team where as they continue to build out their resume, resilience can be a storyline for, you know, internal programs for us to talk about on this podcast. But from other players' perspectives, you just kind of end up whether you have a 4-goal lead, 5-goal lead, 1-goal lead, you kind of just white knuckle your stick and you just think, okay, like, you know, let's make sure that we're not taking our foot off the gas here. And anytime you kind of have those thoughts trickle into your head where you're not comfortable with that lead and you're not confident that you'll be able to kind of, you know, maintain that lead because of their performances this season, it just makes it all the more interesting and it gives me all the more momentum if I'm a player on DU, knowing that that, you know, it's kind of like the game theory. They know that we know that we can come back. So I think, you know, the Hopkins and the Cornell for DU is going to pay off massive dividends, even from the psyche of another player who might find themselves up by 3 or 4 goals at any point during the season.
Quick Notre Dame-Georgetown update. We just had Ty Banks slide high and late to Chris Kavanaugh and knock his helmet off.
There need to be like a special Cascade Kavanaugh line where it's like molded into your head, because the amount of times their helmets come off is somewhat concerning. And that's a little bit about how they play, but it also represents...
It's also a little bit about how they buckle their chin strap, which is not...
Buckle the chin strap, but, you know, 2 minutes non-releasable and maybe give a, you know, serve a warrant. Throw him in prison.
I mean, he's a Canadian. He might get deported.
Yeah, I'm calling the Mounties. That was a tough little cross-check. I still think, and I can't remember his name, but that Duke player from the national championship last year, the Duke player that lost the national championship, that tried to kill either Pat or Chris Kavanaugh.
It was Chris. And I'm pretty sure you're talking about Kenny Brower.
Yeah, Kenny Brower. Meet me in the parking lot one day, buckaroo. And then I'll say, like, hey, that was a messed up hit. Do you want to grab a beer? I am all talk. But the way that the Kavanaughs play every time, I'm just like, oh, dude, be careful. But this 2-minute non-releasable should be the spark to give my final prediction, 13-9, the juice that it needs. Anyways, DU's good.
Yeah. Well, just a couple more things about this game. So the first is, I was so impressed by AJ Mercurio. You know, there were 33 goals scored in this game, and we talked about the role that extra man played on, and it was a very important role in the outcome of the game. But there were also a lot of transition goals both directions. Luke Gilmartin had a really nice transition goal for Cornell, but AJ Mercurio made a lot of things happen, and I was really impressed by that. There were also a couple of junk garbage goals that I thought were you know, really kind of emblematic, I guess is the right word. DJ Clark, man, he's a freshman from Lawrenceville, another Canadian, and I saw him play last year against Boys Latin, and I came away from that thinking, this kid is as close to Owen Hiltz as I have seen in a really long time. And he's number 36. I didn't feel like he really kind of imposed his will on the first couple games of the season, at least in terms of what I noticed, but I felt like he made a ton of plays in this one. Equivalently, kind of on the other end, I thought that when Willem Firth was getting a short stick, Cornell did a really nice job of attacking with him and facilitating through him. I also thought that it was interesting how early on it felt like CJ Kirst wasn't trying to push the issue and didn't want to make the game like kind of about him, so to speak. And then in the middle of the second quarter, he scored back-to-back goals, and it felt like from that point, he was a little bit more interested in imposing his will. But you're right. Like, I thought that Jack DiBenedetto did a really nice job of either limiting him the ball, making his shots difficult to can, and whatever the case may be. So, just a really high-quality game. It'll be an interesting one a month from now to look back on and say, not the result. Like, the result is the result, and that's not, I don't think, going to deviate very much. It's more so the performance. What are we going to take away? What is sustainable from what we saw out of Denver? I mean, I don't expect this to be a team that's going to score 17 goals a game. I meant to make this point, but, you know, I'll revisit it now. All season long, we've talked about how they don't have an alpha Dodger offensively, right? We talked about it with J.J. Solstrup, too. The question, or the way in which they, you know, continue to manifest in it is, they play 6-on-6 as if it's extra man. The number of goals that they score through adjacent passes is remarkably high, and it just really calls into question, effectively, like, how do you want to approach supporting defensively against this team? Because if you do hedge, their shooters are good enough, and their spacing is good enough, and their positioning is appropriate such that they will move one more. It's a 6 to 8 yard pass, and it opens up a really nice step down look from an intermediate mid range. And that's how they scored a disproportionate number of their goals that fell outside of extra man transition and some of those garbage goals that we talked about. So just a really nice coaching job, right? And especially because Matt Brown and Dave Metzbauer have been so X attack oriented over the course of their entirety of their careers, right? You know, we talked about it in terms of Brownie, his offensive philosophy is to do a lot of kabuki theater on the front side, move the ball as quickly to the backside, and attack the backside in a mismatch format. Whether it was Ryan Boyle or the 2016 North Carolina team, Metzi's teams want to attack from X. They want to draw that short slide, and then they want to move, or they want to, you know, kind of dodge from up top, bang it through X, and again, kind of get it to the backside for the shooters. I'm not seeing a ton of that in the goals that I'm seeing get scored by Denver so far this year. So I just want to applaud that staff for the evolution that that shows. And, you know, now we get a Notre Dame extra man goal to go ahead 7-6 with, what, 62 seconds left on this penalty?
Yeah, right around there. And I will, you know, again, hated Matt Brown in college. I even played a D-Elite for him, and we butted heads because he was a professional and I was a complete high school jackass. And I was like, why does Coach Brown hate me? And then upon reflection, it's like, maybe because you were being a complete idiot all day. But what I really respect is exactly what you just called out, is the offenses of yesteryear for DU specifically. And what's nice is I've shared enough locker rooms where I've talked about practice structure with guys like Westberg, with, you know, Canizero, with enough people to, you know, you just sit around and talk about, you know, what were your brutal practices like? How was your time at DU? And it's funny stylistically, because the DUs and the Notre Dames and the Virginias, we're just like, yeah, we're going to have, you know, 6'2 to 6'4 guys, and we're going to be bigger, faster, stronger, and we're going to try and wear you down. And DU has always been the polar opposite, even in their practice structure, where we were hearing about like what their skeleton offense looks like, what their stick skill development looks like. And we're like, yeah, but when do you guys get huge and fast and physical? And they're like, what are you talking about? We're playing lacrosse. And I'm like, what are you talking about? We're playing lacrosse. And so within that evolution of, they have better stick skills collectively than most offenses, and they lean on that heavier, it's been really cool to see that adjustment from, hey, we're just going to initiate to X, to this quick ball movement in the shot clock is not only hard to play against defensively, but it takes it a step further in the practice structure. I hated preparing for Albany and DU because we didn't have anybody that could emulate the Thompsons, and we didn't have ball movement that could prepare us for the speed at which Denver does that. So I think what we're taking away from Denver, if they can comfortably settle into that historically good ball movement, quick, okay, well, I hedged, I stayed on my guy, or I slid, all three of those are incorrect decisions based on how they play, I think that settled is just going to take them, you know, to the next level. And again, DU and Syracuse worry me now, you know, if I'm any other team, more so than at the beginning of the season. So credit to Coach Brown. Sorry for how I acted in high school. But also go Irish, and I'm sneaky rooting for DU despite your turf.
Up next,
the second, I mean, there were just three really good games. So DU Cornell, fantastic. The most exciting finish, Penn Delaware. So first things first, one of my favorite kind of flubs of the year so far. Somehow there were two balls that were allowed to be played at once. A shot went out of bounds. Somebody secured the shot that went out of bounds, and then somebody grabbed another one from the end line. And there was probably about 5 to 6 seconds of two balls being played at the same time. And then the ref stopped it, and everybody was chaotic. So that was a beautiful little, that's why we played the game, for fun moments like that. But Penn sneaks past Delaware 11-10. Delaware, good program. So this is a big win for Penn. Really, the best part of the game was the final, like, 15 seconds. So J.P. Ward, who's an absolute stud, many saying he's stud. Jake Hervada, who I think is their assistant, he's been touting J.P. Ward on Twitter, saying he's been disrespected, he should be in the Twarton conversation. Hey, here's some clout. J.P. Ward is good. Everybody good? Okay, good. He scored with, I think, 14 or 13 seconds left on a great from X shooting up the wing. And then the face-off.
To make it 11-10.
To make it 11-10, one-goal game. And Robinson wins the face-off, brings it down, gets a great look and hits the pipe, and there was like that big rebound scramble opportunity. Nope. And in the same way that we were just talking about, this was another game of runs. Delaware was up 7-4. Then Penn was up 9-7. And then it kind of evened out to a bit more of a slugfest at the end. But a much, much needed win for Penn. And what are the takeaways here, Terry?
I mean, I don't want to always default to the same point that we've made a bunch of times, but you know, this time last week we were talking about Penn losing to Georgetown, and I was kind of dismissive or whatever, reductive is probably the better word for it, by saying Penn is good, they're going to play a ton of close games, the margin of their season is going to be defined by the narrowest factors, right? Because that's how they have been for 10 years. And I feel like this is another example of that, right? Like, Delaware is a good team. To beat Delaware at home by one is a good result. And to do so in dramatic fashion. This was a team that didn't Penn score in, like, if not successive weeks, like 3 out of 4 weeks, they scored a goal with 2 seconds left, and then a goal with 1 second left, and then a goal with like 0.1 seconds left in order to like win all three games against, like, I don't know, Duke and whomever. So this is just who they are. This is how they play. That Mike Robinson shot that hit the far pipe, just, I don't understand how it even is physically possible. It was insane. So Matt Kinnear was on site for this one. He actually did the Philadelphia double dip. He had two choices for the early game slot, and he chose Villanova versus Colgate, which ended up being the wrong choice. He should have gone to Drexel Albany, because that was another overtime game. And that Drexel ended up winning after what should have been, or appears to have, should have been a Albany game winner with about 3 seconds to go that ended up getting waved off, because of goalie interference. But, we're shouting out more folks who are doing things on Twitter, former players, that is. Bradley Voigt, posted a video that pretty clearly showed that there was no goalie interference, but there was no review capacity on site at Drexel. And so as a result, the Dragons come away with a win. So yeah, a crazy day of games in Philadelphia, and the Quakers are now 2-1 after having beaten Albany earlier in the week, in order to rebound from that early season loss to Georgetown.
And this podcast is going to be pretty consistently interrupted by Notre Dame Georgetown, but that was just an absolute wild back and forth. This game is starting to become nutso.
As I was talking about Mike Robinson hitting the far post, Eric Dobson hit the far post low to low, and the ball stayed out. We're tied 7-7.
No, we're not. We're not tied 7-7, actually. It's actually 8-7. Nice try, Terry.
Correct.
He scored.
Looks
right,
like Jeffrey Richardelli,
right?
Right?
Yeah. And it's too early to discuss superlatives, and I don't think we did enough on the superlatives last year. So maybe we have like a heat meter for what superlatives are going to be one at the end of the year. Most stressed out fan base has to be Penn so far.
Oh my God. Yeah, for sure.
They just refuse to play a game that isn't a nail biter right down to the end. And you talked about it just a second ago, but it seems like in the last 2 years, if you're a Penn fan, it's just, okay, here we go. I'm going to need, you know, a pack of darts for after the game, and, you know, maybe some Xanax and maybe some Zoloft, something. So Penn fans, maybe look to secure a sponsorship from your local pharmaceutical rep.
How are Crimson fans, Harvard Crimson fans, feeling today, Nikki?
Harvard Crimson fans are feeling, well, they should be
similar.
Feeling good. Yeah, similar, because that's the third game that we're going to discuss that was just an absolute nail biter. And again, the theme of the weekend, and what I'm going to argue is the theme of the year, hopefully it keeps up, is just no lead is insurmountable, or no lead is safe, no comeback is insurmountable. So Harvard Bucknell. Now, this game doesn't usually, you know, crack the top three, but, you know, we're going to call it the Kim Kardashian comeback of the week. Down 7 goals, 8-1 in the second quarter, Harvard came back to ultimately win 13-12. Harvard had 7 goals just in the fourth quarter. Jerry Byrne leading a team, mounting a great comeback. Stop me if you've heard that one before. Who would have ever thought? Quick shout out to Malone, who had 3 goals in the fourth, and Sam King with 5 points, 2 goals, 3 assists. Great job for the Crimson. And this is another program that when Coach Byrne left and started coaching at Harvard, I immediately had them at about national championship level in 5 years. That's the amount of respect and how good of a coach that I think has for him. So while I don't think this win represents that they're on track to be the title contender, I think it's a great example of some of the things that he can implement in a program, which is, I don't care who it is, I don't care what the score is, we are going to go out and ball out and do our best. Good job, Crimson. And between Penn and Harvard, Georgetown just scored. I'm still keeping tabs on the Ivy League from 3 or 4 years ago. Penn and Harvard sneak away with it.
Yeah, it was so this game was played at a neutral site, Staples in Westport, Connecticut. And I'm actually just catching up on it, on these goals right now. Teddy Malone just... This was a game where I was just very impressed by the certitude, forcefulness of Harvard's Dodgers. And, they played with force. And we're starting to kind of look at these results as a matrix now, right? So Dartmouth gets its first win under Sean Kerwin over Holy Cross on Saturday. Hopper Zapatello, who missed their first game, I believe due to a head injury, had 2 goals and 6 assists. Dartmouth lost to Bucknell in their opener, and you wonder if Zapatello was available for that game. Is that enough to determine or, to change the outcome? This was one where Bucknell got out to an 8-1 lead, and at that point, I stopped tracking the game because I didn't think that it was feasible for Harvard to have a comeback like this in them. So I'm with you. Incredible job by the Crimson, and it was quite a showing.
And speaking of quite a showing, I was almost thinking about kicking off this podcast by saying that the refs were flown in from Georgetown's HQ, and now all of a sudden Notre Dame's had 8 penalties called in their favor, maybe 100. I'm trying to keep track here, but really need to start converting. It's 8-8 right now. And while I love the Kavanaugh, Jake Taylor, let's all be crafty and do all that, sometimes I just want to see Dobson shoot it 150 miles an hour. I want him to shoot every shot for the rest of the game. So first 3 games, very exciting. We're kind of going off a large cliff of excitement. And hey, we will talk about NJIT.
Hold your tongue.
We will talk about NJIT at some point. Everybody hold
your tongue. No, we got to talk about it now.
We're talking about it right now?
Yeah.
We're talking about it right now. Okay.
We're talking about it right
NJIT,
now.
The New Jersey Institute of Technology, is 5-0.
Yes. The only team in the country who's 5-0.
The only team in the country is 5-0. Notre Dame scores. How you doing? You wanted to talk about this late in the podcast because I think you're just kind of an elitist who doesn't give respect to NJIT. Me personally, I'm a man of the people, so I bumped it up in the rundown. Let's speak our piece and discuss if NJIT is America's team. I'm arguing no because I think that New Jersey has too many flaws to truly be America's team. But NJIT, you keep this run up, you're certainly in the running.
So the Highlanders are, I believe, in their 7th season, maybe 8th. Eric Wolf, who was a longtime assistant at Harvard and Albany and had previously been the head coach at LIU, took over and is in his 2nd season. And they got off to a 4-0 start with wins over St. John's, Siena, Mount St. Mary's, and Monmouth. And Matt Kinnear, who goes back with Eric a long way, spoke to him in the middle of this week after they had gotten off to that 4-0 start, and wrote an article that went up on Friday afternoon or Friday morning about that 4-0 start that the Highlanders had experienced. And basically just to give you a little bit of a window into Inside Lacrosse's editorial process, we've got like 4 or 5 folks that write and edit. And so not everybody kind of reads or sees every story before it goes live. And that was the case in this instance. Kevin Brown edited the story for Matt. It was up for a few hours. And then I had somebody text me and they were like, oh my God, this story is incredible. You have to check it out. So I did. And I came to the very same conclusion. So on Saturday morning, before I headed down to College Park, I just tweeted it out. And I was like, the first game of the day is about NJIT. You guys got to read this story. It's like the best way to kick off a lacrosse Saturday. And then I just had the game on my iPad. And it was looking pretty handily like NJIT was going to go to 5-0. And then all of a sudden, the Jaspers pulled out a little bit of magic, and all of a sudden, it got a little bit greater into doubt. Tied the game. I believe it was 10-10. And then Liam Brown, NJIT goalie, makes a save. The Highlanders clear. Coach Wolf, thank you for joining us.
Thanks
I don't
for
know if
boys.
I know. I don't know if I know how to pronounce the midfielder's last name who scored that game-winning goal. So if you wouldn't mind just kind of recounting for us how the last minute of action unfolded, that would be awesome.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a blur for me as well with the three games in 7 days. But that was Owen Corey who had the game winner. Liam had a big stop. We came down, let the boys go from D to O, which we tend to do. Our guys tend to do better when they're not thinking, and usually at timeouts we just start thinking. So I'm certainly not trying to screw them up. So we let him go, and we did a lot of work in the 5v5 subbing stuff. So he just went pretty simply left to right, just kind of out-athleted the kid and put it in the corner and, you know, puts us over the top.
But it didn't end there.
What's that?
It did not end there.
No. Well, that was the game winner. Which game are you talking about? You're talking about Manhattan?
Yeah.
Yeah. Owen had the game winner. Are you talking about the game tying goal?
No, I'm talking about the game winning goal. But then it so happened that you lose the faceoff, and now you have to hold on and make sure that you close this one out.
Yeah, it definitely got a little bit dicey. I guess we lost the next faceoff. That's what I'm saying, man. Like, I really don't remember what happened the last 7 days.
And then Liam had the game saving save in order to seal the victory. It was dramatic. It was awesome.
Yeah, I'm probably doing a disservice to what actually happened in the game, but I mean, Liam's been huge for us, and he made, you know, big saves like he always tends to. I mean, he's the all-time leading saves, you know, leader in program history, and, you know, the kid's seen a lot of rubber, man. He's done a great job. But, yeah, it was a little bit hectic, and, you know, we kept the ball on the ground at the end of the game and were able to, you know, hold on, which was a little bit different than the previous games where we had to, you know, kind of crawl back into it. This was kind of like, you know, you're at the end of your rope, tie a knot, and just kind of hang on.
So, Coach Wolf, to let you know that my co-host here is a Notre Dame alum, and they are currently playing a one-goal game against Georgetown. If you feel like he's distracted, it's because he's watching the game behind the computer.
Listen,
he's a professional.
I'm a professional.
He's a professional, so he can do two things at once. Coach.
Listen, I got the game on in the other room, except I have a little bit more discipline, so I went into the other room.
could never be me. I do better when I'm not thinking, so I'm trying
to
have as many distractions.
That's a heck of a game going right now.
So, just like I said, to take a step back, to be the first 5-0 team in the country for a group that you're effectively, you know, less than 2 years in with, what do you ascribe it to? How has this journey unfolded, and what has been, you know, kind of, I don't want to say special about this season, because I know that folks in your position who have to be process oriented understand that, you know, the results don't always indicate exactly what's happening. So I don't want to overreact to the results, because I'm sure that there are aspects of progress that you saw last year that just couldn't quite manifest in the results in such a stark way as they have this year. But that being said, how do you describe what this season has been and kind of how it's punctuated basically your tenure here so far, as short as it may be, at NJIT?
Yeah, I mean, you touched on it, being process driven, and as cliche as it is, you know, it is the way. For us, I've just tried to get everybody going in the same direction. I mentioned, you know, our parents group, our administration, our alumni, our kids. You know, we needed everybody focused mentally and emotionally and physically on the same thing. You know, which sometimes, you know, I don't know that what I was selling was all that difficult for them to get behind when they had struggled as much as they did. And, you know, the results didn't come relatively quickly, you know, in that first year, but we just tried to be consistent with them on a day-to-day basis. And what I communicated to them from day one was how we feel about you as humans and as people is not going to be dictated by what they do on Saturdays on game day. You know, and after losses for a coach, it's just very difficult to stay true to that. But that first year, I was very consistent with them on Mondays after, you know, losses, and I wasn't screaming and yelling at them because I couldn't get them to do what I wanted them to do at the rate at which I wanted them to do. It was just about, you know, evolving, growing, getting better, and starting to believe in themselves a little bit. So for everything with our guys, it was about the belief and the confidence that for whatever reason they had just lost. And I just inherited a group that I thought had some talent that just needed a little bit of probably some more pats on the backs than they did kicks in the butt. you know, which sometimes comes with losing. And I think just being consistent as a staff with the boys over the last year and a half has gotten them to really believe. And certainly the success, you know, on game day in terms of wins and losses, that stuff always helps. But it has been a process. We've been consistent. And for me, I got to take care of myself, which is I got to eat, I got to sleep. I got to make sure I got enough time with my family at home. And, you know, that way I'm balanced and I'm able to stand in front of a group of 47, 18, and 23-year-old males and lead. So it's not like one thing that I can point to that's been like, all right, we've arrived, we're here, which again, I still don't feel that we're anywhere near the level that I would like our team to be at. But I think it's been a culmination of a lot of people, you know, kind of pulling the oars in the same direction.
I just hear you say they needed some pats on the back, but when you say they needed some kicks in the butts, I still get some shivers. Because I remember when Coach Corgan would be like, yeah, we just need to kick these guys in the butt a little bit. I'm like, oh, it's going to be a long day.
Yeah.
But thank you for joining and taking the time. Really appreciate it. I have two questions. And from the player's perspective, you know, to have a team like yours that's starting off 5-0, can you just give me some insight into what the locker room post game looks like? Like there just has to be this big palpable energy momentum that explodes every time the clocks hit zero. And while the job certainly is not finished by any means, those celebrations of those wins just has to be, I would argue, the best locker room in the country right now.
Yeah, to be honest with you, I don't spend much time in there. I do believe the locker room is a bit of a, you know, a sanctuary for the boys. I don't think I really belong in there. I'm not a big speak to the team guy after wins, after losses, because for me, it's the same concept. I've been in locker rooms where, you know, I've given out game balls or seen other head coaches give out game balls, and we watch the film, we're like, what the heck were we thinking? And then I've been in a locker room maybe, you know, when I was, early in my career where I've maybe shredded a guy or two, or I've heard some other coaches start pointing the finger after a loss, and you just say things that you regret. So for me, after games, I'm usually, we love you, go hug and, you know, kiss the people that you love, get some food in you. I guarantee you're going to feel differently than you do 48 hours from now. With that being said, has the locker room been electric? Yeah, it's been electric.
Yeah.
You know, I brought my son in there, who's about 16 months old. You know, after the game on Saturday, we had about 7 or 8 alum, and we brought him in. You know, just told him how proud we were of him. And, you know, I Saturday was pretty electric because I told them I'm not going to see him till Tuesday. So we gave him off Sunday, Monday. So they were pretty fired up with that. Just again, the three games in 7 days at any level, it's just a lot. So, yeah, it's been electric, and you know, I'm sure there's a lot of fun stuff that I don't know about that's going on. Cause I tend to dip out of there pretty quick cause I just don't think it's my place, and it is for the boys to enjoy and celebrate. And no one's really celebrating at the rate at which they like when the head coach is around. So I tend to get out of there pretty quick. You'd have a better luck talking to the boys.
Boy, and let me just say, if you're listening to this for the first time, that's probably the best answer I've ever heard from any coach for anything. Hey, how's the locker room? Hey, that's not really my business. That's their sanctuary. I mean, Terry, we should clip that and post that because that'll get 6 or 7 recruits right there, I would hope. And then the second question, bit of a stupid one that I'm going to be taking to Twitter later today. NJIT, America's team? Are they America's team 2024? What do you think?
I've seen that on whatever. I don't spend a whole lot of time on social media. I don't have any like individual accounts or anything like that. It's again just not a space that I like to operate in. I certainly understand it, and I saw whoever was posting that stuff. I do think we're a story that's easy to get behind. I really do. You know, kids that really struggled and you know that have been the underdog, and you know, like I said in the article with Maddie, like, you know, the kids went home in the summer and they just get made fun of. Like, that was what they dealt with every single summer. You know, and we just, for them, I just told them, like, that's not on my watch. Like, that's just not going to happen. I don't identify with or understand, you know, frankly, all the struggles and stuff that happened in the past, but that's just not the way that I roll. And I've been fortunate to be a part of some pretty successful teams and successful programs, so I know what it's like on the other side. And a lot of it for me just starts with belief and confidence. And you know, that first year, we were leaning more towards arrogance than humility. We didn't need to be humble. We've been humbled for, I think, a very long time. Now, you know, as you get some attention and you do have some wins, you got to walk that line between arrogance and confidence. And that's what I think good teams always do. And I remember the Notre Dame teams going up against you guys, like when I was an assistant at Albany, you felt that that confidence, almost a little bit of arrogance. But like any good team that I've ever been on, they walk that line. And, you know, that's I think the challenge for this group right now is how far can we push it?
Yeah, that was all my teammates. I was never the type of arrogant player. But, no, it's interesting to hear, you know, scrappy group that was being mistreated to rise, you know, rise above. Kind of sounds a little bit like, I don't know, 1776, scrappy group of colonies, you know, rising up, getting a little attention, getting a little success. Closely mirrors a story that I'm familiar with. So I might be on the NJIT America's team bandwagon.
I don't get involved in politics, man. So you drive the narrative, man. I'll listen.
All right, perfect.
Nick has such a funny joke for people who are not involved in politics. In any case, so you've kind of laid out how you got to this point. But what I'm interested in is, and you kind of started to touch on it with respect to toeing the line, right? Is where does it go from here? And the thing about the article that I love the most is that I am such an ardent believer in the fact that teams are born out of like what's in here, right? And your comments about you have to believe and you have to learn how to win, and you're starting to do it, right? But that doesn't mean that you've done it to the extent that you need to in order to meet your goals. And I don't know what this team's goals are. I don't know what your personal opinion of having goals as a team actually is. But with that being said, you know, you've got a few more non-conference games before America East play starts. What does this look like on a day-to-day and week-to-week basis over the course of the next, let's just say, month?
Yeah, you know, this week was different. We didn't practice this week. You know, we had the game got pushed from Saturday at Mount to Sunday. You know, then we came back Monday. You know, I think we had some film. Tuesday, we walked through. Wednesday, we played. Thursday was probably as emotionally drained as I have been really in the past year and a half. Like, I felt great after the Manhattan game. I was like, I can coach again. After the Monmouth game, I was like, I got nothing left in the tank. And then I actually did go back in the locker room, you know, and I just got him a little bit fired up. I was like, can we get one more, you know, and all the boys got pretty jacked up there. What does it look like for the next month? You know, as again, cliche, but like for us, the goal for our group as a team was to just try and reach our potential and become the best possible version of, you know, ourselves that we could be. If we're caught up in, you know, attention and, you know, winning games and our record, then, you know, we're not going to become that team, you know, and I'm like, whether the boys are aware or not, I'm coming down their road on Tuesday at practice, and it's going to be a bear. So, you know, Tuesday and Wednesday, we're going to get after it. We're going to try and get better. We have to get better. There are a lot of things that we need to correct. But, you know, where is the line with the arrogance and confidence? I did a little, like, basketball interview for one of our basketball games with one of our local guys, and he had, and I've gotten a bunch of text about this week before the week that they had said, hey, tough week for you. My response was tough week for our opponents, because they have to play us. And I again, is that arrogance? I don't know, but I just believe it. And that's not disrespect to any of the opponents that we have, but I've just always believed that any time that I step out onto a field or, you know, I'm competing, that's my mindset, is that we're coming for you. You know, we're not, you know, being hunted. We're the hunters. So, you know, it is a fine line to walk. And again, I don't mean disrespect to anybody that we play, because every team that we played, especially, you know, the last two games, which came down to the wire, you know, both teams were just resilient, you know, to the last whistle. So, you know, that it is a fine line to walk, but I've any team, like I said, that I've been a part of that's been successful, you walk that line.
Eric Wolf, we really appreciate you joining the Tailgate Podcast. Good luck as you guys continue with this hot start. Enjoy the rest, and we look forward to watching the Highlanders become America's team.
And sorry about what all my teammates said back in the Notre Dame Albany days. Those guys were real cocky, arrogant jerks sometimes. Not me, though.
I don't even remember it, so we'll be good. Never happened.
Perfect. Sounds good. Good luck, Coach.
All right, boys. Thanks, guys.
I can't get over that question about how he just wanted to leave the locker room alone. That's honestly like, hey, you know, sometimes you can be too critical in the heat of the moment. Sometimes you can hand out game balls to guys who you watch film and they stunk it up. That was a phenomenal answer. So shout 100%. Out to Coach Wolf.
And especially because, like, I don't think that's the intuitive reason that a coach wouldn't want to go into the locker room, right? Like, you don't go in there because of it's the sanctuary part of it, right? That's, I think, reasonable, intuitive, whatever. But I really appreciate that additional color that it's like, I don't want to make mistakes. And you kind of, it's kind of funny because I've heard about that and I've talked to coaches about that all the time where, you know, when they say, I haven't watched the film yet, so I don't know, when you ask them a question in postgame, if you're like kind of a, I don't know. I don't want to call it like a young reporter or somebody who doesn't necessarily like understand exactly how nuanced the job is. You can kind of think that they're using it as coach speak to not actually like, you know, explain it away. But no, it's legit. And yeah, I'm with you. That was a really good answer. I'm glad we got him.
So am I. Hope that interview also, turns this out. Georgetown Notre Dame game is stupid, and we need to start having a discussion. Hey, the goal review, is it ruining college lacrosse?
I'm getting multiple text messages as this game is going on to that exact effect, which is crazy because after the Maryland game yesterday, so John Tillman is the chair of the rules committee. You know, I had conversations with him over the summer when this rule came in. I talked to him a couple weeks ago. I talked to him last Sunday, and then I talked to him again about it yesterday, and what I said yesterday was kind of, you know, my opinion has evolved, which is that my main concern was that there were going to be too many reviews and they were going to take too long. But through yesterday, I hadn't felt that way. I thought that the number of reviews and how efficiently they were conducted was actually pretty good. And then I saw the Albany Drexel non-goal that could have won the game for the Great Danes, and it actually pushed me even further toward my opinion that, like, no, this review thing is kind of working out pretty well for the sport. But it seems like this game is kind of shifting the tides of that opinion, huh?
Yeah, and there was a just speaking in generalities, reviews in sports. I was calling the Seals game this past Friday. It was a Friday game, late night. And in the first quarter, I think we were like 3 minutes in. Oh, God. Nice save. Way to sell out there. There was a review that took, I think, about 3 minutes. And here's a take. The goal review, the time it takes to have a goal review strictly depends on how good the broadcasters are. Whether or not I did a good job, I have no idea. But I feel like, as a producer, the goal review time should just be time to riff bits as announcers, make jokes, talk smack, that should be the time that broadcasters are most worried to get canceled, because there were things that I wanted to say where I was like, well, AJ, you know, we have about 3 minutes here. Let's talk politics. Who are you going to vote for? Like, you know, I feel like that could be a great way to fill some of the time, is just, it turns into a borderline stand-up comedy show. But, hey, we got a minute
between
left.
Between two non-stand-up comedians.
Between two terrible, between two terrible stand-up comedians.
Minute to go here in this Georgetown-Notre Dame game. The Hoyas are up 10-9, Notre Dame in possession. Nick, do you want to broadcast this game? Do you want to do the play-by-play?
No, because now there's a timeout, and now
yeah,
we're going to have
we got to fill
so
time.
So anyways, Terry, who are you voting for? we'll quickly go through this one. We might have to cut it off, but Maryland beats Princeton. This game went, relatively speaking, about as what you would expect. Maryland ended up winning 13-7. The interesting point for me here was this was Princeton's third game in 6 days.
Yeah, just like NJIT.
Yeah, boo to the schedulers on that one. Like, what are we doing here, fellas? So to cap off 3-6 with Maryland, I think the writing was on the wall right there, but that was the first thing that noticed. And then the second is obviously Weirman going 20 for 23 at the X. We've talked about this very Irish goaltender for Princeton, Gianfacaro. Hey, that's a nice spicy sauce. He played well and was really the reason why this game wasn't a big blowout. So shout out to Spanos had 5 points and Malever had 5. I love butchering these names and I'm never not going to. Game was 6-1 and then 8-2, ultimately 13-7. Terry, any takeaways?
Yeah, so I was in the building. I every kind of thing that happened throughout the game, the only rationale was, like, these are two teams in completely different points in their season. And Maryland is contending for a national championship, right? You know, we've talked about it all year long. In my opinion, they were very clearly the fourth team coming into the season. I think they're very clearly the fourth team right now. That means they're a Final Four team. That means you're a national championship contender. Princeton has lost successive classes of like 9 contributors, right? So they should theoretically have a completely new top 18, top 20, whatever the case may be. And they don't. But they are breaking in like 8-9 new guys. And, you know, some of them, Colin Burns and Nate Kibiri, are well-known recruits that are freshmen. That's not surprising. But there are sophomores and juniors who haven't played a ton who are getting their first real minutes. And so, you know, was fatigue an issue? talked to the Maryland staff post, you know, at the end of the game. They didn't necessarily think so. You know, Paul Wethington, who's kind of like this year's Bo Pettersson, came out of halftime limping. So, you know, they knew that that was going to be a little bit of an issue.
Oh, my! Terry Foy, how you doing?
That was Pat Kavanaugh. Pat Kavanaugh with the rolling back to his righty, it. Going high to high.
Oh, God, those high to highs just look so good. And Georgetown's goalie's been playing good all game. But Dobson's high to high, and then that one right there. My goodness. And Corrigan still looks like he's about to rip everybody's head off. God, what a beautiful, hey, oh, hey, good defense. But what if I just did a little whoop, roll back, high to high, near side? What a scumbag you are, Pat Kavanaugh. The cockiness to go near side, stick side high on a right-handed goalie is just fantastic. Oh, have a day, fellas. Anyways, you were talking about Maryland?
You're not going to give credit to the back screen that Jake Taylor set that didn't actually affect the play very much because there was another 20 yards of running afterwards, but that was a creative little screen at the top of the box to try to get PKAV a little bit of space.
Yeah, but it didn't.
39 seconds to go, and we are facing off 10-10.
Oh, get the first chance ground ball, please. How you doing?
No, he scuffed the first time ground ball because he knew that a Georgetown attackman coming out of the box was going to hit him high and late and they were going to get a man up.
Yeah.
But that's not what happened.
Yeah. This has been a very good technical sliding game with just shoulders going into throats. and now with another timeout, you know, time to riff bits about politics for the announcers. So hopefully Quint tees up some good, good Trump and Biden bits.
So the face-off situation was going to be an interesting one. There was a lot made of Tyler Sandoval's return. He was less than a year post-op from an ACL tear. And he only took, I think it was five. At least when I checked, I think he was 2 for 5. Andrew Meekin, who is one of those guys who's getting his first opportunity to contribute in a substantial way. When I checked at the same time, I think he was 2 for 13. So he was definitely struggling. And Luke Weirman, you know, we talked about it last week too. Or maybe it was 2 weeks ago. If I've got to pick a guy to win the ball forward and score a goal in college lacrosse, it's Luke Weirman. So that created a possession advantage that was going to be almost impossible to overcome. You know, both offenses converted about 29%. So if the possessions were even, you would have assumed that it would have been an even game. And I think that, you know, to an extent, that's what we saw. Obviously, Mike G putting up 20 saves, which tied a career high, is it's not a recipe for winning. But at the same time, you know, if you're Maryland, you're like, how often do we get saved 20 times and win, much less win comfortably? So I take this game as Maryland beat a good team who is going to get much better as the season goes along. That win is going to look better in May than it does right now. And for Princeton, who now turns around and heads to Carolina and takes on Carolina on Friday and Duke on Sunday, like, they need an opportunity to catch their breath. They need an opportunity to watch film. They need an opportunity to practice and implement the things that they've learned from watching film. And while, you know, they don't really have a ton of time, right? It's kind of a no rest for the weary type situation because they're definitely bussing. I assume they're bussing, and I'm assuming that they're leaving on Thursday.
Double team. Force feed into the double team.
Good collapse.
7 seconds. Okay, nothing. If this is how we lose, I'm hanging up. Oi! Okay, care everybody. Just relax. All right, hey, a little bonus lacrosse action. How you doing?
The officials definitely didn't have an opinion on whether or not that was a loose ball trip on Notre Dame, huh?
No, that was a clean play. When you throw a cross check, if you hit directly in between their numbers on the back of the jersey, that's technically sound.
Oh, couple other results that you want to swing through really quick?
Yeah, heart rate's up right now. So we have a couple other.
This is professional broadcasting at its best.
Yeah, a couple other games to check in on. The recurring segment is just going to be the Larkin Kemp, are you okay game of the week. Brown loses to Providence 12-11 in overtime. Two others, and I feel like I like proposing three results and then just letting you choose the storyline.
Sure.
The Larkin Kemp wellness check game of the week. Hopkins beats the ACC stepchild UNC 13-9. Rutgers stomps Loyola 13-5. Out of those three, which one is going to give you the most fun to talk about?
Yeah, I enjoy this part of the podcast as well. I am going to eliminate the Larkin Kemp wellness check because his brother, Phil is his brother, correct?
I believe so.
Is in the NHL. So he can withstand a few bare Bruno losses, and it's still going okay for Kempin Ain't Easy, right?
Kempin seems pretty easy, but you know what? Hey, apparently it's not easy.
So, yeah, I think Hawks Carolina's up next on my to-watch list, so to speak. So I don't have a ton to say about that. Obviously, it was so rich narrative-wise, storyline-wise, so I could talk about that, but, you know, that's just kind of dumb sports reporter-type stuff. It had to be cool. I'm going to do it anyway, so it had to be cool for Dom Petrimala to score a goal against Hopkins. You know, it's... I the fact that Dave's teams are 0-3 against Hopkins between the two Syracuse years and this year Carolina, I don't care at all about.
You know, not even a little bit, not even just kind of a chuckle.
No, not at all. Because I mean, so Syracuse Hopkins is in 2 weeks. I mean, I would take Syracuse right now. So if Dave had stayed and was coaching the Syracuse team, that stat wouldn't be true. Right, I would take them regardless of who was coaching the defense. So, I mean, it's. I was watching. I had the Loyola Rutgers game on my iPad while I was at the Maryland Princeton game.
Sorry to cut you off, but let's just do a little overtime challenge. Who you got scoring?
Jake Taylor.
I have Eric Dobson.
Okay. Well, what about for Georgetown?
nobody.
I'm gonna go TJ Haley, which is like the most. I should get like 1,000-to-1 odds if. Oh, you got it. They call time. Yeah, you call
time out. All right, Riff Bits. Hey, wow. Who are you voting for? This Jake Taylor guy from Florida. Okay, anyways, go ahead.
Great hands.
Jake Taylor, not the best. Eric Dobson, was at Mar-a-Lago? I think Dobson grew up at Mar-a-Lago. And that's talking politics. All right, anyways, back to Hopkins and UNC.
Yeah, so no, we're talking Loyola Rutgers. It was 11-2 at one point, I think. So the Greyhounds managed to outscore the Scarlet Knights 3-2 down the stretch and make the scoreline a little bit more amenable.
I'm a little more amenable. Still not looking good.
I mean, we're watching Georgetown hold a Notre Dame team that scored on better than 50% of its possessions in the first two games. They've held them to 10 goals in more than 60 minutes so far today. This Georgetown team gave up 18 goals to Loyola, who have then put up 4, 7, and 5 in successive weeks.
Make that make sense.
Well, I think it makes sense both directions, right? So incredible improvement out of Georgetown. They talked about it early in the broadcast here in this Notre Dame game. And then on top of that, I mean, it's not fool's gold. It's just that... Loyola has not found a repeatable source of offense, right? Now, it's exacerbated when they're not winning faceoffs consistently, but it's even not just about that, right? There have been games, possessions, moments where even when they got the ball, because they were getting stops and they were clearing the ball, they just weren't able to manifest anything on a consistent basis. And we've got Pat Cavanaugh ISO at the top of the box against a short stick. This is Danger Will Robinson
early
zone.
Slide, get it out of your stick backside. Oh, you had Dobson there. Dobson, step in. Uh-oh. High bouncer. Oh, you sick.
All right, we get a... Was that... Who's 29? That was not Taylor on the BTB attempt.
Well, I'm watching from pretty far away, so I'm just having to guess based off of height, weight.
High drama. Oh, that was Devin McClain with the BTB attempt.
Yeah, the low angle BTB is like, oh, the behind the back improves your ankle, and that was still shot from about 1 yard. The head of his stick was 1 yard above GLE, but I like it regardless. Notre Dame's defense, I haven't been impressed with their ability to get out and impact the quality of Georgetown's passes at any point throughout the game. I'd like to see a little more active sticks and not let Georgetown settle in consistently. Like, even that pass right there, like, take the extra step to try and close the gap. Even on those simple exchanges, they add up over the course of a possession.
So is that to say that you want to see the Fighting Irish cause more turnovers?
Not cause more turnovers. Disrupt the flow. So
just make sure the offense is not comfortable.
Oh, don't go for the behind the head. Yep. Hey, anytime you chase stick. Hey, kids, anytime you chase stick when they go to the middle of the field, it's going to result in a goal. What are we doing? Stay consistent with the lifts. And this is classic Coach Corrigan. You know, he saw what Duke has done in previous years where they're like, hey, let's drop one early in the season. And now everybody that has Notre Dame on their schedule can expect a blowout loss. So, oh. But no, you don't go and try and get on the hands to cause turnovers. You do that to impact the quality of passes. And Coach Byrne always said that the best compliment that you can receive is a coach in the post-game press or the opposing coach go, yeah, we just couldn't really get into the flow of our offense. We couldn't really get it going. And I feel like Georgetown's offense was getting it going. More active sticks, more lift checks, more poke checks as those passes are being released, and that goal doesn't happen.
Aiden Carroll isolates on the right side of the defense, sweeps across the top of the defense against Ben Ramsey, isolated on a short stick, my favorite short stick in college lacrosse. He had him, and he could have tried to catch up and turn him back, but he decided to go for the over-the-head check, missed the over-the-head check. Really nice job by Carroll. And then he – really nice placement off hip against Liam Entenmann. Ball game, 11-10.
The inside right there made it difficult for Notre Dame to realize who was the slide guy. They kind of ran like a – as he was going through his dodge, it looked like there may have been even three people on the crease at one point. And that's always tough because you're the slide guy, but then one of your teammates comes into the crease, and then you have to communicate through that while paying attention to the job. So whether that was intentional for Georgetown or not, that crease movement was late at the slide. So it's that trickle up economy.
So, Nick, we just heard from Eric Wolf that you shouldn't make judgments immediately following a game, either game balls or ripping into somebody. So we shouldn't be analyzing until we have had an opportunity to watch the film. You were podcasting during the second half of this. Any takeaways on Notre Dame's first loss since Virginia in the regular season last year, right?
I believe so because Notre Dame didn't lose in the playoffs last year. For
right,
sure,
yeah.
Because we won it. I don't know. I think the things that we have to figure out offensively, and this is speaking in dumb generalities, so I can rewatch this game and provide a better analysis next week, but you can only rely on talent so much. It seemed like a decent amount of Notre Dame's goals was that instance of Pat Kavanaugh kind of coming off of a dodge and then hitting a rollback into a high-to-high was the last goal for Notre Dame. But that wasn't, you know, there wasn't the off-ball movement to get Jake Taylor open and just, you know, dunk. There wasn't the, you know, when Eric Dobson even dodged and shot high-to-high, there was still traffic in front of him. Like, there shouldn't be that traffic. You should very clearly make sure that there's enough space so that he can see a slide guy or see his shot coming off. So I think, as much as I hate to say this, more structure around the offense so that you can break down the defense without having to rely so much on individual talent, which while Notre Dame has a lot of, doesn't end up benefiting you in the long run. Have Dobson come out of the box. Have a two-man game on the crease with Taylor while Dobson's coming out of the box. I know Corrigan has a ton of those tricks, and it's always that, well, was it implemented correctly? Were they running it and executing well? Or was it just kind of a, you know, draw it up to any other thing? But more structure and set plays to start, which will allow that individual talent to have no-brainer goals as opposed to, you know, Notre Dame kind of had to score incredible goals all game. That's my takeaway.
Excellent analysis. And I think it's a great way to end this edition of the Tailgate Podcast. This is a wild show.
It's kind of,
we should record during Notre Dame games all the time.
I don't know if my heart can take it. But I hope for the listeners, give us feedback on if this was good or if it was like, oh, this is about to be a really good point. And then I just go, oh, whoa, geez. So let us know. Maybe we start recording during Notre Dame games.
Nick, that'll do it. If you like what you heard, leave a rating and review. Tell a friend. We'll be back next week. I'm actually going to Carolina.
Ooh.
You're going to love this. Yeah, I'm going. So we're going to be able to do the double dip between the Princeton-Carolina game and then the Duke-Penn game on Friday night, and then we're stopping on the way back, and we're going to Virginia Hopkins. So it's a big weekend for your boy. I'm going to be road tripping with Dan Abern and Kevin Brown. So we'll be back next Sunday with a lot of firsthand reaction.
Nice.
Some of the best that we see in college lacrosse. And we're going to get an opportunity to watch the Terps and the Irish on Sunday. So this literally could just be a reprisal.
Yep. And broadcast season is picking up. I got the Toronto Rock at San Diego on the 2nd. So we'll have to work around that.
Hotel internet, here we come.
Oh, I love it. They actually, I don't know if they improved it, but it was better last week or this.
Got a lot of jokes.
Last couple days. The only other thing that I want to say, any players, if you're listening to this, whether it's Ajax Zapatello, Chase Ireland, or any player, clout's more important than team meetings. Clout is more important than recovery sessions. So if we ask you to be on the podcast, hey, clear your schedule and know what rules the world. And that's clout. And the best way to do that is with the Tailgate Podcast. Terry, thank you. I love you.
Love you.